Maya was adamant that they should all get down immediately into the southern polar region to tell the underground what had happened. "It's not so easy," Coyote said. "They know we were in Casey Valles, and since they had time to get Sax to talk, they probably know we'll be trying to get back south. They can look at a map as well as we can and see that the equator is basically blocked from West Tharsis all the way to the east of the Chaoses. There's the gap between Pavonis and Noctis," Maya said. "Yes, but there's several pistes and pipelines crossing that, and two wraps of the elevator. I've got tunnels built under all those, but if they're looking, they might find some of them or see our cars. So what are you saying?" "I think we have to go around, north of Tharsis and Olympus Mons, and then down Amazonas and cross the equator there." Maya shook her head. "We need to get south fast to let them know they've been found out." Coyote thought about it. "We can split up," he said. "I've got a little ultralight plane stashed in a hideout near the foot of Ekkas Overlook. Casey can lead you and Michelle to it and fly you back south. We'll follow by way of Amazonas." "What about Sax?" "We'll take him straight to Tharsis Tholis. There's a Bogdanovist med clinic there. That's only two nights away." Maya talked it over with Michelle and Casey, never even glancing at Spencer. Michelle and Casey were agreeable, and finally she nodded. "All right, we're off south. Come down as quickly as you can." They drove by night and slept by day in their old pattern, and in two nights made their way across Ekkas Chasma to Tharsis Tholis, a volcanic cone on the northern edge of the Tharsis Bulge. There, a Nicosia-class tent town called Tharsis Tholis was located on the black flank of its namesake. The town was part of the Demimonde. Most of its citizens were living ordinary lives in the surface net, but many of them were Bogdanovists who helped support Bogdanovist refuges in the area, as well as Red Sanctuaries in Mariatis and on the Great Escarpment. And they helped other people in the town who had left the net or been off it since birth. The biggest med clinic in town was Bogdanovist and served many of the underground. So they drove right up to the tent and plugged into its garage and got out. And soon a little ambulance car came and rushed Sax to the clinic near the center of town. The rest of them walked down the grassy main street after him, feeling the roominess after all those days in the cars. Art goggled at their open behavior, and Nergal briefly explained the Demimonde to him as they walked to a cafe with some safe rooms upstairs, across from the clinic. At the clinic itself, they were already at work on Sax. A few hours after their arrival, Nergal was allowed to clean up and change into sterile clothes, and then go in to sit with him. They had him on a ventilator which was circulating a liquid through his lungs. One could see it in the clear tubes and the mask covering his face, looking like clouded water. It was an awful thing to see, as if they were drowning him. But the liquid was a perfluorocarbon-based mixture, and it transferred to Sax three times as much oxygen as air would have, and flushed out the gunk that had been accumulating in his lungs and reinflated collapsed airways, and was spiked with a variety of drugs and medicines. The med tech working on Sax explained all this to Nergal as she worked. "He had a bit of edema, so it's kind of a paradoxical treatment, but it works." And so Nergal sat, his hand on Sax's arm, watching the fluid inside the mask that was taped to Sax's lower face, swirling in and out of him. "It's like he's back in an ectogene tank," Nergal said. "Or," the medtech said, looking at him curiously, "in the womb." "Yes, being reborn. He doesn't even look the same." "Keep that hand on him," the tech advised, and went away. Nergal sat and tried to feel how Sax was doing, tried to feel that vitality struggling in its own processes, swimming back up into the world. Sax's temperature fluctuated in alarming little swoops and dives. Other medical people came in and held instruments against Sax's head and face, talking among themselves in low voices. "Some damage. Anterior left side. We'll see." The same tech came in a few nights later when Nergal was there and said, "Hold his head, Nergal. left side around the ear. Just above it, yeah. Hold it there and... yeah, like that. Now do what you do. What? You know. Send heat into him. And she left hastily, as if embarrassed to have made such a suggestion, or frightened. Nergal sat and collected himself. He located the fire within and tried running some of it into his hand and across into sacks. Heat. Heat. A tentative jolt of whiteness sent into the injured green. Then feeling again, trying to read the heat of Sax's head. Days passed, and Nergal spent most of them at the clinic. One night he was coming back from the kitchens when the young tech came running down the hall to him, grabbing him by the arm and saying, "Come on, come on!" And the next thing he knew, he was down in the room holding Sax's head, his breath short and all his muscles like wires. There were three doctors in there and some more techs. One doctor put out an arm toward Nergal, and the young tech stepped in between them. He felt something inside Sax stir, as if going away or coming back. Some passage. He poured into Sax every bit of veriditas he could muster, suddenly terrified, stricken with memories of the clinic in Zygote, of sitting with Simon, that look on Simon's face the night he died. The perfluorocarbon liquid swirled in and out of Sax, a quick, shallow tide. Nergal watched it, thinking about Simon. His hand lost its heat, and he couldn't bring it back. Sax would know who it was with hands so warm, if it mattered. But as it was, all he could do, he exerted himself, pushed as if the world were freezing, as if he could pull back not only Sax, but also Simon, if he pushed hard enough. "Why, Sax?" he said softly into the ear by his hand. "But why? Why, Sax? But why? Why, Sax? But why? Why, Sax? But why?" The perfluorocarbon swirled. The overlit room hummed. The doctors worked at the machines and over Sax's body, glancing at each other, at Nergal. The word "why" became nothing but a sound, a kind of prayer. An hour passed, and then more hours, slow and anxious, until they fell into a kind of timeless state, and Nergal couldn't have said whether it was day or night. "Payment for our bodies," he thought. "We pay." One evening, about a week after their arrival, they pumped Sax's lungs clear and took the ventilator off. Sax gasped loudly, then breathed. He was an air breather again, a mammal. They had repaired his nose, although it was now a different shape, almost as flat as it had been before his cosmetic surgery. His bruises were still spectacular. About an hour after they took the ventilator off, he regained consciousness. He blinked and blinked. He looked around the room, then looked very closely at Nergal, clutching his hand hard, but he didn't speak, and soon he was asleep. Nergal went out into the green streets of the small town, dominated by the cone of Tharsis Tholus, rising in black and rust majesty to the north like a squat Fuji. He ran in his rhythmic way around and around the tent wall as he burned off some of his excess energy. Sax and his great unexplainable... They were staying in rooms over a cafe across the street, and there he found Coyote hobbling restlessly from window to window, muttering and singing wordless calypso tunes. "What's wrong?" Nergal said. Coyote waggled both hands. "Now that Sax is stabilized, we should get out of here. You and Spencer can tend to Sax in the car while we drive west around Olympus." "Okay," Nergal said. "When they say Sax is ready." Coyote stared at him. "They say you saved him. That you brought him back from the dead." Nergal shook his head, frightened at the very thought. "He never died." "I figured. But that's what they're saying." Coyote regarded him thoughtfully. "You'll have to be careful." They drove by night, contouring around the slope of North Tharsis, sacks propped on the couch in the compartment behind the drivers. Within hours of their departure, Coyote said, "I want to hit one of the mining camps run by Subarashi and Saronius." He looked at Sax. "It's okay with you?" Sax nodded. His raccoon bruises were now green and purple. "Why can't you talk?" Art asked him. Sax shrugged, croaked once or twice. They rolled on. From the bottom of the northern side of the Tharsis Bulge, there extends an array of parallel canyons called the Saronius Fossae. There are as many as 40 of these fractures, depending on how you count them, as some of the indentations are canyons, while others are only isolated ridges or deep cracks or simply corrugations in the plain, all running north and south, and all cutting into a metallogenic province of great richness, a basalt mass rifted with all kinds of ore intrusions from below. So there were a lot of mining settlements and mobile rigs in these canyons, and now, as he contemplated them on his maps, Coyote rubbed his hands together. "Your capture set me free, Sax. Since they know we're out here anyway, there's no reason we shouldn't put some of them out of business and grab some uranium while we're at it." So he stopped one night at the southern end of Tractus Catena, the longest and deepest of the canyons. Its beginning was a strange sight. The relatively smooth plain was disrupted by what looked like a ramp that cut into the ground, a ramp about 3 kilometers wide and eventually about 300 meters deep, running right over the horizon to the north in a perfectly straight line. They slept through the morning and then spent the afternoon sitting in the living compartment nervously, looking at satellite photos and listening to Coyote's instructions. "Is there a chance we'll kill these miners?" Art asked, pulling at his big, whiskery jaw. Coyote shrugged. "It might happen." Sax shook his head back and forth vehemently. "Not so rough with your head," Nergal said to him. "I agree with Sax," Art said quickly. "I mean, even setting aside moral considerations, which I don't, it's still stupid just as a practical matter. It's stupid because it makes the assumption that your enemies are weaker than you and will do what you want if you murder a few of them. But people aren't like that. I mean, think about how it will fall out. You go down that canyon and kill a bunch of people doing their jobs, and later other people come along and find the bodies. They'll hate you forever. Even if you do take over Mars someday, they'll still hate you and do anything they can to screw things up, and that's all you will have accomplished because they'll replace those miners quick as that." Art glanced at Sax, who was sitting up on the couch, watching him closely. "On the other hand, say you go down there and do something that causes those miners to run into their emergency shelter, and then you lock them in the shelter and wreck their machines. They call for help, they hang out there, and in a day or two somebody comes to rescue them. They're mad, but also they're thinking we could be dead. Those Reds wrecked our stuff and were gone in a flash. We never even saw them. They could have killed us, but they didn't. And the people who rescued them will be thinking the same. And then, later on, when you've taken over Mars, or when you're trying to, they remember, and they all dive off into hostage syndrome and start rooting for you, or working with you." Sax was nodding. Spencer was looking at Nergal. And then they all were, all but Coyote, who was looking down at the palms of his hands as if reading them. And then he looked up, and he too was looking at Nergal. For Nergal it was simple, and he regarded Coyote with some concern. "Art's right. Hiroko will never forgive us if we start killing people for no reason." Coyote's face twisted, as if in disgust for their softness. "We just killed a bunch of people in Cassay Vallis," he said. "But that was different," Nergal said. "How so?" Nergal hesitated, unsure, and Art said quickly, "Those were a bunch of police torturers who had your buddy and were microwaving his brain. They got what was coming to them. But these guys down this canyon are just digging up rocks." Sax nodded. He was staring at them all with the utmost intensity, and it seemed certain that he understood everything and was deeply engaged in it. But mute as he was, it was hard to be sure. Coyote stared hard at Art. "Is this a praxis mine?" "I don't know. I don't care, either." "Hmm. Well..." Coyote looked at Sax, then at Spencer, then at Nergal, who could feel his cheeks burning. "All right, then. We'll try it your way." And so at the end of the day, Nergal climbed out of the rover with Coyote and Art. The sky above was dark and starry, the western quadrant still purple, casting a florid light in which everything was quite visible, but at the same time unfamiliar. Coyote led the way, and Art and Nergal followed him closely. Through his faceplate, Nergal could see that Art's eyes were pressing glass. The floor of Tractus Catena was broken at one point by a transverse fault system called Tractus Traction, and the trellis fracturing in this zone had formed a system of crevasses impenetrable to vehicles. The Tractus miners reached their camp from the canyon wall above it, descending in elevators. But Coyote said it was possible to walk through Tractus Traction following a path of connecting crevasses he had marked for himself. Many of his resistance actions involved crossing impassable terrain like this, making possible some of his more legendary impossible visitations, and sending him through badlands no one else had ever even approached. And with Nergal to run some of the raids, they had performed some truly miraculous-seeming ventures, just by getting out and traveling by foot. So they jogged down the canyon floor in the steady Martian lope that Nergal had perfected and had tried with partial success to teach to Coyote. Art was not graceful. His stride was too short, and he stumbled frequently, but he kept up. Nergal began to feel the loose joy of running, the boulder ballet of it, the rapid crossing of long stretches of land under his own power. Also the rhythmic breathing, the bounce of his air tank on his back, the trance-like state that he had learned over the years with help from the Issei Nanao, who had been taught Lungam on Earth by a Tibetan adept. Nanao claimed that some of the old Lungampas had had to carry weights to keep from flying away, and on Mars it seemed entirely possible. The way he could fly over rocks was exhilarating, a kind of rapture. He had to restrain himself. Neither Coyote nor Art knew Lungam, and they couldn't keep up, though they were both pretty good. Coyote for his age, Art for his recent arrival on Mars. Coyote knew the land and ran in short, mincing dance steps, efficient and clean. Art bombed over the landscape like a badly programmed robot, staggering often as he hit wrong in the starlight, but keeping up a pretty good head of steam nevertheless. Nergal ranged in front of them like a dog. Twice, Art went down in a cloud of dust, and Nergal ran over to check on him, but both times Art got up jogging, and in their intercom silence he only waved to Nergal and ran on. After half an hour's run down the canyon, which was so straight that it seemed cut by design, cracks appeared on the ground and quickly deepened and connected up with one another until progress over the canyon floor proper would have been impossible, as it was now the plateau tops of a collection of islands. The deep slots separating these islands were in places only 2 or 3 meters wide, but 30 or 40 meters deep. Walking through these generally flat-floored alleys was a strange business, but Coyote led the way through the maze without delaying at any of the many forks, following a path only he knew, turning left and right a score of times. One slot was so narrow they could touch both walls at once, and they had to scrape through a turn. When they came out the northern side of the crevasse maze, emerging from a draw in the riven steep escarpment, which was the end of the plateau islands, a small tent stood before them against the western canyon wall. Its arc of fabric glowed like the bulb of a dusty lamp. Within the tent were mobile trailers, rovers, drills, earth movers, and other mining equipment. It was a uranium mine called Pitchblende Alley because this lower section of the canyon was floored with a pegmatite extremely rich in uraninite. It was a very productive mine, and Coyote had heard that the processed uranium stockpiled at it during the years between elevators had not yet been shipped out. Now Coyote ran over the canyon floor toward the tent, and Nergal and Art followed. There was no one visible inside the tent. The only illumination was provided by a few nightlights and the lit windows of a big trailer set near the center of things. Coyote walked right up to the tent's nearest lock gate, and the other two followed him. He plugged his wrist pad jack into the keyhole by the lock gate and began to tap on his wrist pad. The outer lock door opened. No alarms seemed to go off. No figures appeared out of the door of the trailer. They got in the lock, closed the outer door, waited for the lock to suck and pump, then opened the inner door. Coyote ran toward the settlement's little physical plant beside the trailer. Nergal went for the living quarters, hopping up the steps to the trailer's door. He held one of Coyote's locking bars under the door handle, turned the dial that released the fixative, and pushed the bar against the door and wall of the trailer. The trailer was made of a magnesium-based alloy, and the polymer fixative would make what was in effect a ceramic bond between the locking bar and the trailer so that the door would be stuck. He ran around the trailer and did the same to the other door, then dashed back toward the gate, feeling his blood fly through him as if it were pure adrenaline. It was so much like a prank that he had to consciously remember the explosive charges that Coyote and Art were distributing through the settlement, in warehouses, against the tent fabric, and in the parking lot for the mining behemoths. Nergal joined them in running from vehicle to vehicle, climbing the stairs on their sides, opening doors manually or electronically, tossing small boxes Coyote had provided into the cabs or cabins. But there were also hundreds of tons of processed uranium that Coyote wanted to haul away. This was impossible, unfortunately. They did run over to a warehouse, however, where they filled a number of the mine's own robot trucks with loads and programmed them with instructions to head off into the canyonlands to the north, burying loads in regions where the apatite concentrations might be high enough to disguise the boxed uranium's radioactivity and make the loads hard to relocate. Spencer had doubted this strategy would work, but Coyote said it beat leaving the uranium at the mine, and all of them were happy to help in any plan that would keep him from putting tons of uranium in the storage hold of their boulder car, rad-proof containers or not. When that was done, they ran back to the gate and got back outside and ran hard. Halfway to the escarpment, they heard a series of pops and booms from the tent, and Nergal glanced over his shoulder but saw nothing different. The tent was still mostly dark, the trailer windows lit. He turned and ran on, feeling as if he were flying, and was astonished to see Art racing over the canyon floor ahead of him, every stride a huge wild leap, bounding like some cheetah bear all the way to the escarpment, where he had to wait for Coyote to catch up and lead them back through the crevasse maze. Once out of it, he took off again, so fast that Nergal decided to try to catch him just to feel how fast it was. He got into the rhythm of the sprint, pressing harder and harder, and as he passed Art, he saw that his own springbok strides were almost twice as long as Art's, even in sprint mode, where both their legs were pumping as fast as possible. They got to the boulder car long before Coyote and waited for him in the lock, catching their breath, grinning through their faceplates at each other. A few minutes later, Coyote was there and in with them, and Spencer had the rover moving with the time slip just passed and 6 more hours of night to drive in. Inside, they laughed hard at Art's mad run, but he only grinned and waved them off. "I wasn't scared. It's this Martian gravity, I tell you. I was just running the way I usually would, but my legs were leaping like a tiger. Amazing!" They rested through the day, and after dark they were off again. They passed the mouth of a long canyon that ran from Saronius to Jovis Tholus. It was an oddity in that it was neither straight nor sinuous and was called Crooked Canyon. When the sun rose, they were hidden on the apron of Crater QR just north of Jovis Tholus. Jovis Tholis was a bigger volcano than Tharsis Tholis, bigger in fact than any volcano on Earth, but it was located on the high saddle between Ascrius Mons and Olympus Mons, and both were visible on skysills to east and west, bulking like vast plateau continents and making Jovis seem compact, friendly, comprehensible. A hill you could walk up if you wanted to. That day, Sax sat and stared silently at his screen, tapping at it tentatively and getting a random assortment of texts, maps, diagrams, pictures, equations. He tilted his head at each with no sign of recognition. Nergal sat down beside him. "Sax, can you hear what I'm saying?" Sax looked at him. "Can you understand my words? Nod if you understand." Sax tilted his head to the side. Nergal sighed, held by that inquisitive look. Sax nodded, hesitantly. That night, Coyote drove west again toward Olympus, and near dawn he directed the rover right up to a wall of parked and riven black basalt. This was the edge of a tableland cut by innumerable marrow-twisting ravines, like Tractus Traction, only on a much larger scale, creating a Badlands like an immense expansion of the Traction's maze. The tableland was a fan of broken ancient lava, the remnant of one of the earliest flows from Olympus Mons, capping softer tuffin ash from even earlier eruptions. Where the wind-cut ravines had worn deep enough, their bottoms broke through into the layer of softer tuff, so that some ravines were narrow slots with tunnels at their bottoms, rounded by eons of wind. "Like upside-down keyholes," Coyote said, though Nergal had never seen a keyhole remotely like these shapes. Coyote drove the rover right into one of the black and gray tunnel ravines. Several kilometers up the tunnel, he stopped the car beside a wall of tenting that cut off a kind of embolism in the tunnel, a widened outer curve. This was the first hidden sanctuary that Art had ever seen, and he looked suitably startled. The tent was perhaps 20 meters tall, containing a section of the curve 100 meters long. Art exclaimed over the size of it until Nergal had to laugh. "Someone else is already here using it," Coyote said, "so be quiet for a second." Art nodded quickly and leaned over Coyote's shoulder to hear what he was saying over the intercom. Parked before the tent lock was another car, just as lumpish and rocky as their own. "Ah," said Coyote, pushing Art back. "It's Vishka. They'll have oranges and maybe some kava. We'll have a party this morning for sure." They rolled up to the tent lock, and a coupler tube reached out and clamped around their exterior door. When all the lock doors were opened, they made their way into the tent, bending and shuffling to carry Sax through the tube with them. They were met inside by 8 tall, dark-skinned people, 5 women and 3 men, a loud group, happy to have company. Coyote introduced them all, although Nergal knew Vishka from the university in Sabishi, and gave her a big hug. She was pleased to see him again, and led them all back to the smooth curve of the cliff wall, into a clearing between trailers, under a skylight provided by a vertical crack in the old lava. Under this shaft of diffuse daylight, and the even more diffuse light from the deep ravine outside the tent, the visitors sat on broad, flat pillows around low tables, while several of their hosts went to work at a clutch of round-bellied samovars. Coyote was talking with acquaintances, catching up on the news. Sax looked around, blinking, and Spencer, beside him, didn't look much less confused. He had been living in the surface world since 61, and his knowledge of the sanctuaries must have been almost entirely second-hand. 40 years of a double life. It was no wonder he looked stunned. Coyote went to the samovars and began handing out tiny cups from a freestanding cabinet. Nergal sat next to Vishka, an arm around her waist, soaking in her warmth and buzzing with the long contact of her leg against his. Art sat down on her other side, his broad face thrust into the conversation like a dog's. Vishka introduced herself to him and shook his hand. He clasped her long, delicate fingers in his big paw as if he wanted to kiss them. These are Bogdanovists, Nergal explained to Art, laughing at his expression and handing him one of the little ceramic cups from Coyote. Their parents were prisoners in Korolyov before the war. Ah, Art said. We're a long way from there, right? Vishka said, Yes, well, our parents took the Trans-Marineris Highway north just before it was flooded, and eventually they came here. Here, take that tray from Coyote and go pass out cups and introduce yourself to everyone. So Art made the rounds, and Nergal caught up on news with Vishka. You won't believe what we found in one of these tough tunnels, she told him. We've become most fantastically rich. Everyone had their cup, so they all paused for a moment and took their first sips together. Then, after some whoops and a general smacking of the lips, they went back to their conversations. Art returned to Nergal's side. Here, have some yourself, Nergal told him. Everyone needs to join the toast. That's the way they do it. Art took a sip from his cup, looking dubious at the liquid, which was blacker than coffee and foul-smelling. He shuddered. It's like coffee with licorice mixed into it, poisoned licorice. Vishka laughed. It's kava java, she said, a mixture of kava and coffee. Very strong and it tastes like hell, and hard to come by, but don't give up on it. If you can get a cup down, you'll find it's worth it. If you say so. Manfully, he downed another swallow, shuddering again. Horrible. Yes, but we like it. Some people just extract the Kavayan from the kava, but I don't think that's right. Rituals should have some unpleasantness, or you don't appreciate them properly. Art said. Nergal and Vishka watched him. I'm in a refuge of the Martian underground, he said after a while. Getting high on some weird, awful drug in the company of some of the most famous lost members of the First Hundred, as well as young natives never known to Earth. It's working, Vishka observed. Coyote was talking to a woman who, though sitting in the lotus position on one of the pillows, was just below his eye level as he stood before her. Sure, I'd like to have romaine lettuce seeds, the woman said. But you have to take fair for something so valuable. They're not that valuable, Coyote said in his plausible style. You're already giving us more nitrogen than we can burn. Sure, but you have to get nitrogen before you can give it. I know that. Get before you give, and give before you burn. And here we've found this enormous vein of sodium nitrate. It's pure caliche blanco, and these badlands are stuffed with it. It looks like there's a band of it between the tuff and the lava, about 3 meters thick and extending, well, we don't even know how far yet. It's a huge amount of nitrogen, and we've got to get rid of it. Fine, fine, Coyote said, but that's no reason to start potlatching on us. We're not potlatching. You're going to burn 80% of what we give you. 70. Oh, yeah, 70. And then we'll have these seeds, and we'll finally be able to eat decent salads with our meals. If you can get them to grow, lettuce is delicate. We'll have all the fertilizer we need. Coyote laughed. I guess so, but it's still out of whack. Tell you what, we'll give you the coordinates for one of those trucks of uranium we sent off into Saronius. Talk about potlatching. No, because there's no guarantee that you'll be able to recover the stuff. But you'll know where it is, and if you do recover it, then you can just burn another picobar of nitrogen and we'll be even. How about that? It still seems like too much to me. You're gonna be feeling like that all the time with this caliche blanco you've found. There's really that much of it? Tons of it. Millions of tons of it. These badlands are layered through and through with it. All right, maybe we can get some hydrogen peroxide from you, too. We're gonna need the fuel for the trip south. Art leaned toward them as if pulled by a magnet. What's Caliche Blanco. It's nearly pure sodium nitrate, the woman said. She described the areology of the region. Rhyolitic tuff, the light-colored rock surrounding them, had been overlaid by the dark andesite lava that roofed the tableland. Erosion had carved the tuff wherever cracks in the andesite exposed it, forming the tunnel-bottomed ravines and also revealing great seams of caliche trapped between the two layers. The caliche is loose rock and dust, cemented together with salts and the sodium nitrates. Microorganisms must have laid that layer down, a man beyond the woman said, but she instantly disagreed. It could have been aerothermal or lightning attracted by the quartz in the tuff. They argued in the way people do when they're repeating a debate for the thousandth time. Art interrupted to ask again about the caliche blanco. The woman explained that blanco was a very pure caliche, up to 80% pure sodium nitrate, and thus, on this nitrogen-poor world, extremely valuable. A block of it sat on the table, and she passed it over to Art and went back to arguing with her friend, while Coyote bartered on with another man, talking about teeter-totters and pots, kilograms and calories, equivalents and overburden, cubic meters per second and picobars, haggling expertly and getting a lot of laughs from the people listening. At one point, the woman interrupted Coyote with a cry. Look, we can't just take an unknown pot of uranium that we can't be sure we'll get or not. That's either gross potlatching or else ripping us off, depending on whether we can find the truck or not. What kind of a deal is that? I mean, it's a lousy deal either way. Coyote wagged his head mischievously. I had to bring it in, or else otherwise you were going to bury me in Caliche Blanco, weren't you? We're out here on the road. We've got some seeds, but not much else. Certainly not millions of tons of new caliche deposits. And we actually need the hydrogen peroxide and the pasta, too. It's not just a luxury like lettuce seeds. Tell you what, if you find the truck, you can burn its equivalent, and you'll still have given us fair. If you don't find it, then you'll owe us one, I admit it. But in that case, you can burn a gift, and then we'll have given you fair. It'll take a week's work and a bunch of fuel to recover the truck. All right, we'll take another 10 picobars and burn 6 of it. Done. The woman shook her head, baffled. You're a hard bastard. Coyote nodded and got up to go refill their cups. Art swung his head around and stared at Nergal, his mouth hanging open. Explain to me what just went on there. Well, said Nergal, feeling the benevolence of the kava flowing through him, they were trading. We need food and fuel, so we were at a disadvantage, but Coyote did pretty well. Art hefted the white block. But what's this get nitrogen and give nitrogen and burn nitrogen? What, do you torch your money when you get it? Well, some of it, yeah. So both of them were trying to lose? To lose? To come out short in the deal? Short? To give more than they got? Well, sure, of course. Oh, of course, Art rolled his eyes. But you can't give too much more than you get, did I understand that? Right, that would be potlatching. Nergal watched his new friend mull this over. But if you always give more than you get, how do you get anything to give, if you see what I mean? Nergal shrugged, glanced at Vizhka, hugged her waist suggestively. You have to find it, I guess, or make it. Ah, it's the gift economy, Vizhka told him. The gift economy? It's part of how we run things out here. There's a money economy for the old buy-and-pay system, using units of hydrogen peroxide as the money. But most people try to do as much as they can by the nitrogen standard, which is the gift economy. The Sufis started that, and the people in Nergal's home. And Coyote, Nergal added. Although, as he glanced over at his father, he could see that Art might find it hard to envision Coyote as any sort of economic theorist. At the moment, Coyote was tapping madly at a keyboard beside another man, and when he lost the game they were playing, he shoved the man off his pillow, explaining to everyone that his hand had slipped. "I'll arm wrestle you double or nothing," he said. And he and the man plunked their elbows on the table and tensed their forearms and went at it. "Arm wrestling," Art said. "Now that's something I can understand." Coyote lost in seconds, and Art sat down to challenge the winner. He won in seconds, and it quickly became obvious that no one could resist him. The Bogdanovists even clustered across from him and got three and then four hands clasping his hand and wrist, but he smacked every combination of them down onto the table. "Okay, I win," he said at last, and flopped back on his pillow. "How much do I owe you?"
This ends side 2 of cassette 9 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 10.